in order to talk about digestion and for it to be in the Ayurvedic context, it would be important for me to know that you have an understanding of the basic principles of our science. So, the fact that we have principles, and the fact that it's a theoretical system, is an important first step. If we created a contrast between folk medicine and experience-based medicine, as we like to call modern systems, or science-based practices, is that we have a theory, a formal model, and our behaviors, our understandings are all guided by this theoretical system. So we call this modeling, we call it paradigms, we call it hypothesis is associated with it as a term, and from our side, it's important that you understand that while Ayurveda has an origin in what appears to be pure folk medicine, it definitely has a theoretical origin. As far as a point in time, we can say that a body of literature arose which formally set out a theory, and that theory talks about three principal agents of construction and guidance of the entire universe. And those three agents, those three terms, are given by the Sanskrit words up here written on the board, Vata, Pitta, and Kapha. Just briefly, Vata is a substance, Pitta is a substance, Kapha is a substance. And that is a substance. Vata is not a particular chemical formula. It's not a unique formula, but it has general physical characteristics such as air and void. Even vacuum is the substance of the stuff that we call vata. It produces coldness, dryness, lightness, roughness, produces dynamism, animates, moves, produces clarity, thinness, emaciation, and a variety of other things in the universe. So the things that have those effects are, by definition, vata substances. So vata is not a specific substance in a chemical nature, it's a specific substance in a functional nature. It has a functional aspect, and from the material side, it's almost non-material altogether, almost non-material. Air is material. We can feel it moving, but it's almost non-material. And another substance, you know, that's distinguishing itself in a functional way is called Pitta, and its role in our talk today is going to be central, so that the theme of our talk is digestion is going to involve this substance we call Pitta, this category of function which transforms, which mutates, which cooks, which digests, which involves intellection on an abstract principle, and so on and so forth. So we'll talk more about the details of Pitta, but when we talk about digestion, we're going to have to put it into a context. The functional role of Pitta and digestion are overlapping. And the third substance in the universe, in a functional way, is that which supports it's most of the physical structure of the universe, the planets, the stars, the galaxies, the building walls, the floors. Most of the stuff that constructs the body is, in fact, supporting material, and it's kapha in nature. So we have three functional aspects of our science of Ayurveda, the science of life, and when we look at them individually and collectively, there's nothing left out. No substance, no function is beyond the purview of these three taken together. So today we wanted to talk about digestion, and it's a very important theme. It's one of the essential functions of this stuff that we call pitta. Pitta is a Sanskrit word, and one of our classical authorities said it derives from a Sanskrit word that means to cook or to digest. So the main theme of pitta as a category of substances is digestion. When we as Ayurvedists talk of digestion, we're always going to want you to think that digestion, metabolism, absorption and assimilation and discrimination take place. So it's a big mouthful, but the theme of digestion, as we think of it in the stomach and the small intestine, is actually the full process of breaking down, recombining, absorbing, so it gets absorbed into the lining, into the bloodstream, into the lymphatic system, is taken up into the body, and then when the body utilizes it, we make a further distinction, and that's called assimilation. So all of those things take place when we talk about digestion, or we could say they don't take place, but they're supposed to take place. So if I say good digestion, then you should immediately think that all of those functions are taking place in a healthy and balanced way. So healthy digestion means you're absorbing it, you're assimilating it, and it's doing you good and not doing you harm. The concept of pitta is a bodily construct that is oriented towards the body, has a couple of components. And I think it's useful for you to understand that we're aware of the distinctions of the components of things that digest. And so one of the things that digest is heat. And the Sanskrit word for that concept is agni. Some of you have familiarity with Rig Veda. Does anybody here know what Rig Veda is? And the very first word in Rig Veda is agni. The very first word of Rig Veda is agni. And we Vedists, or even Ayurvedists, tend to feel, did you have a question? Or what's the group that has heat in the room, and there's another one that uses agni with heat with the yoga and so on. But this principle of agni is really important, and it's the heat aspect of a pitta substance. So if we take a pitta substance that you're all familiar with conceptually, hydrochloric acid. Hydrochloric acid works because, at least in a chemical way, it's hot. If you touch it, it's going to react with the skin will burn, and it may even discolor, blister, and so on. So the heat portion of the substances which digest, which rule metabolism and govern intellection, discrimination, and so on, that portion in Sanskrit is called agni. I think you should see the obvious connection with igneous, ignite. So they're cognates, right? They're blood relatives. So the Sanskrit word agni in the Latin or the igneous are related. Agni is a Sanskrit word which means that which digests, that which cooks. So its central role is through heat to make some transformations, to make some changes. And when Agni is present, then the process of transformation takes place. Transformations take place with the aid of, or the instrument of, or the application of heat. There, in the universe, there is another substance which shows up in its electromagnetic radiation, but the most important form of electromagnetic radiation is visible light. So all of the light that illumines this and allows us to see ourselves. We tend to group that category of stuff into another Sanskrit word, which is called tejas. Very often in the classical literature, you'll find pitta, agni, and tejas used interchangeably or synonymously. But the scholars like to make the distinction that pitta is the biological substance, agni is the heat aspect, and tejas is the illumination or in the color aspect of it. So things that change color because of heat express tejas. Things that don't change necessarily in form but are visible are seen through the operation of tejas. In order to properly appreciate the Ayurvedic concept, one has to cull the entire Ayurvedic literature. In fact, you'd have to cull the entire Vedic literature. So I heard Lillian mention Mahabharata, and you all know that, and there's a whole group of writings, Smritis, the Puranas, the Itihasas, the history, all kinds of Vedic writings. And in principle, the whole Vedic culture should be searched out, ferreted out for references to Agni in order to understand the concept fully. So this is a brief introduction to this topic by way of my research. I'll just give you a few English terms. The Sanskrit ones aren't going to be intelligible to you, so there's no use to mention them. But the English terms are, by translation at least, terms that mean in English internal fire, bodily fire, heat, the one that digests foods, digestant, the one having flames, one that leaves a black trail. So after a fire, everything is charred and burned and black. I'm just trying to give you a sense of what it is that its function is. And when we go through the list of all the synonyms for it, we see all these terms arising in different places, sometimes interchangeably, but always referring to this concept of Agni, the digestion. Purifier, one that gives color, that which is not satisfied. This is an interesting concept. Once the fire starts, you know that it's hard to stop. Eating one's abode. This is another concept. Everyone here has heard of ulcer. Ulcer is a concept of eating one's abode, the digestant, the hydrochloric acid, or some other stuff that is literally destroying the tissue in the body. There's another concept that uses the equivalent of dry grass. So the substance of dry grass is associated with the concept of Agni because it's a fuel. It is a fuel. Burns quickly. Dazzling as the sun is another synonym. Bringing out leanness, thinness, especially to heal the body. So Agni is varied in its terms, but the essential nature of ugly is transformation. With respect to health and important functional aspects, one classical authority has given these functions and benefits to the concept of agni. When appropriate, when balanced and so on, it will provide strength. So in a sense we could say that it's the basis of strength, good or bad. It's the basis of energy. It's the basis of health. It's the basis of long life. It's the basis of life force. It's the basis of color, nutrition, cheerfulness, muscle tone, which is different from strength, glow, luster, and intelligence. So I think you can appreciate all of these terms in the very simple maxim of our science. The root of all health is based in good digestion. Very simply put, the root of all health is based in good digestion. So one of your members asked me before this talk started about the importance of digestion and the role of digestion in health and its prevalence. And I didn't respond at the time, but we have a statistic from our clinicians, and the clinicians that I study with who come from India say that 85% of the people they see have digestive issues. 85%. So if digestion is the root of all health, or good digestion is the root of all health, it promotes strength, energy, health, long life, life force, color, nutrition, cheerfulness, tone, low intelligence, luster. If it promotes all those things, it's the necessary agent for all those things, and you can see how central it is to life itself. So life is about transformation. It's not only about going places, but it's about making something out of the going. We want to do something when we get there. From a technical standpoint, I'll just give you a few of the terms that are associated with Tejas: color, touch, number, responsible for separation and conjunction, distinction. It's associated with illumination, liquefaction, velocity, and it's associated with the flame of life. It never dies. So the theme of life is eternal. For all of us here in the theosophical mindset, the central premise which underlies our thinking is that life is eternal. We're not maybe all having exactly the same concept of what that fundamental theme of life is, whether it's energetic, what energy is, and whether it has a limited expansion and eternal, universal, infinite nature, or whether it's more limited in its nature and so on. Those things are debatable, but everyone here as a member of this Theosophical Society, and I as representative of a tradition of several thousand years old, affirm that life is essentially energetic in its nature, and it is essentially eternal. So the concept of Agni, the concept of Tejas, taken together, heat, energy, illumination, are the central themes of our topic of digestion. One of the things that I think it's important to mention just in a gloss, all I want to do is give you a highlight of why this concept of Pitta as a biological transformative agent and its features of ugly and tedious, of heat and light, why they're important, and how they're important, and how we see them in the body as playing their role. In Ayurveda, the concept of pitta is that it's basically a single substance by functional nature, not by chemical nature. So light is one aspect, and hydrochloric acid, and enzymes, lipase, amylase, protease, all those are different agnis, or different fires, or different enzymes. But they fall into the category of pitta. What we like to talk about, so that we can be relatively specific with diagnosis and treatment, is how many places in the body show unique characteristics of transformation. And the central fire, the stomach and small intestine, we generally group as a single unit. But in the liver, there are, we could, in the modern sense, we can say that there are five enzymes, or five enzyme principles, or five enzyme systems, which act on food. Food as a non-human form of substance, a non-living form of substance, becomes a living form of material. That is to say, beef protein becomes human protein, or animal protein becomes human protein, through the functioning of a certain set of enzymes in the liver. And there are five of those systems in the liver. So in a sense, we say that there's one agni for the stomach and small intestine, and there are five agnis for the liver, and there are seven more agnis, or enzyme systems, one for each of the tissues which constitute the body. In Ayurveda, the body is constituted by seven tissues. The first tissue that we talk about is plasma, the clear stuff of blood, not the red blood cell in blood, but the clear serum. The second thing that we talk about as a tissue is the red blood cell. We talk about muscle. We talk about fat tissue. We talk about bone tissue. We talk about nerve tissue and bone marrow, and we talk about reproductive tissue. So the reason that it would be important to know this from a theoretical standpoint is that, according to Ayurveda, we can, from manifestation, from personal testimony, from observations and personal testimony, that is, from symptoms which the client reports, and from signs that I can see or measure, those are objective and the subjective things, all taken together, we can assess the agni of the stomach and small intestine. We can assess the agni of the liver enzyme. We can assess the agni of all the tissues individually. Fat materializes uniquely, muscle uniquely, bone uniquely, and because they express and work uniquely in unique functional ways, impaired function is going to involve the idea that agni, some enzyme, something that's responsible for the transformations in that tissue, are taking place. Either they're balanced or healthy, or they're not. And one of the most common things that we see in present clinical experience is weight gain. Weight gain is associated with fat. It might be that there are some other tissues that are accumulating as well. But what this indicates, according to our model, is that the agni, which controls the metabolism, the functioning nature of fat, is weak. Whenever an agni is weak, that tissue in an immature form accumulates in the body. So as obesity sets in, we know not that the stomach and small intestine are out of balance, but we know that they're the main furnace, and they nourish tissue metabolism, but that tissue metabolism is out of whack, and it's depressed. It's as if the body is working overtime to make the tissue that it never quite actually is able to make, and it accumulates. Okay? So from a clinical standpoint, this is a really important observation. We can see when people are overweight. We know that an Agni, an enzyme system, is out of balance, and it is weak. If it were too strong, then we would have the theme of the ulceration, the body would get digested, and emaciation would take place in life. So we can see that as well. And these two points, too little, too much Agni, too little Agni, these two observations are really important clinical discernment. They can usually be made very casually, quickly, superficially, and from a therapeutic standpoint, we will want to make that assessment and then proceed on the basis of other findings, but take this main consideration and our understanding that is, if there's accumulation taking place, the Agni is weak. So we want to revitalize, we want to balance that Agni. So one of the things that I thought would be interesting for members of the group to do would be to do a self-assessment. I have a little inventory for us. And the purpose of it is to look not so much at tissue metabolism or liver enzyme systems, but of the stomach and the small intestine. This is the first stop on the path of studying and understanding, getting acquainted with ourselves and our digestion. So I have a form. You need something to make a mark with, a pencil or paper, a pencil or a pen.
Thank you.
And there are plenty of books off the shelves that you can grab and have a basis of support. This sheet has two sides to it, but I'm giving you the side up that I want you to focus on for the moment. The side up says clinical states of Agni digestion. Sorry. The clinical states of Agni digestion, a self-assessment. So this is a private assessment that I'll just go over, for example, the entries in the first paragraph. Appetite changeable. This might be a little bit ambiguous, but what the sense of it is intended to ferret out is a cause and effect relationship between your lifestyle, your diet, your travel, your eating habits. Whenever things change and your digestion becomes different, then the answer to that is yes. Appetite is changeable. If you have an appetite that's good for lunch and not for dinner, then we would probably think that there's an idea of changeable in it, but especially if today it's good and tomorrow it's not, or if today it's strong and tomorrow it's weak. You understand my point? Just very well. Appetite changes with travel or some disruption of routine. So if you go on a trip, and many people will say, I get constipated. Well, constipation and appetite or digestion are related, but not the same thing. But that would be an indication that something is happening with digestion, that if you get constipated, you lose your appetite, then you would answer yes to that. Sometimes you can skip a meal without noticing, and sometimes without needing to eat. So this is just trying to give you practical ways to understand when your appetite is, according to our assessment, changeable. Now, why don't you finish answering these, and the ones that are yes are the most important to isolate. And you should read the second paragraph. Appetite is always strong. Need to eat three meals per day, and so on. Read that and answer that. And also the appetite is dull paragraph down below.
Single item?
Yes. Well, we're going to see whether there's a grouping that makes sense. So, the first way to do that is to see where the responses are yes. Does everybody have a pencil or a pen? Not everybody does. Carol,
yeah,
can you?
I don't understand this one, the last one, which is rarely snack. It seems to me if you eat three good meals, you just don't need a snack.
That's for you, but for somebody else in this group, that maybe that there's three main meals and five snacks. Grab a book off the shelf if I have permission to authorize that. There's a technical difference, and so, well, don't worry whether you know or understand the difference between appetite and hunger. Just it's not that you'll have 10 answers throughout this page, you might only have one or two. But that one or two will be significant.
Well, so much of this is dependent on what particular eating plan my physician had to be on. Yeah. You know, I can barely remember what my real preferences were before I started trying to lose weight.
Does anybody have more than one yes in more than one category? Oh, how can that be?
What? More than one yes and more than one category?
Yeah.
No, I don't.
You don't? Okay. But Lillian, you said yes? Okay. Who else said yes? Over here? Yeah? So it's pretty likely that one of the things that's going on is that your appetite is variable. It might be strong, it might be okay, it might be weak, or it might be okay. But the fact that it's not consistently strong is an important, or that it is consistently strong is an important thing. That's different from sometimes strong and sometimes not. The sometimes strong, ravenous, and sometimes not is changeable, variable. So sometimes you're going to find people with weak appetite, weak digestion, and it's okay sometimes, but usually the food tends to sit in the stomach or seems to sit in the stomach 6 hours or something like that rather than 2 or 3. So the quality of variability is a very common one, and it plays out with sharp appetite as well as weak appetite. Paradoxically, you can have variable appetite or variable digestion and still have good digestion. It could be unduly good and then normal or weak. Okay? But in that case where it's changeable or variable, that's the more important, whether it's not the identification that it is strong or weak. So, is everyone finished?
So how do you decide how to categorize yourself? Which one you have the most
The discussion that I just had is a preamble, and so we'll go around the room and we'll just take some examples. Who would like to volunteer? Okay. What is your response? Yes, ones only.
Okay. Are we starting with the
middle? Start anywhere on the page you like. It's ravenous?
I would say good to ravenous.
Okay, so your appetite is strong 3 meals a day?
Pretty much.
Do you like to snack, or would you snack if you could?
Sure.
Okay. So those responses tend to fit into the second category predominantly as a category. And so we're going to assume that your answers to that fit into this idea that it's sharp and that pitta is affecting it. That's the conclusion in the results statement below that paragraph alone, right? Results. If more than one yes answer in this category, then the digestion is sharp and pitta is affecting it. So that's a conclusion of therapeutic judgment, and so that's important. So we need to make that judgment before we can decide on how to quote unquote treat it.
I have both sharp and dull. Yeah, I'm not variable.
No, that if you had sharp and dull, then that is variable.
Well, I mean, as far as the answers of the variable category,
I understand that.
Oh, no.
I understand that. But sharp and dull is variable. It is variable to us.
Except that I don't see how, I don't see how that works.
Right, here's the answer. Here's the answer. If your appetite is good, not intense, and not weak, for each meal of the day, then that's what we want. If it's ravenous, then we don't want that. If it's ravenous, means that you can eat undue amounts of food and would prefer to snack and so on. We don't want that. The concept that we're looking for is balance. All right, and so if you have undue appetite, then it's out of balance. The question is, what therapeutic or diagnostic category does it fit in out of balance? What diagnostic category is it out of balance in?
It was like, can't eat heavy food at the time of day. I can, I don't go for it, but I can.
Yeah, right, so the question is, can means that you can also digest it, that you're ready to go for right again. That's not a choice whether you have the option to, it's whether you want to and that you digest it easily. I'll give you an example of undue appetite. One of my teachers said that he knew a yogi that ate 100 eggs at a sitting, got up 2 or 3 hours later and could do the same thing. He literally could digest vast amounts of food almost instantaneously. So this is good digestion, right? But it's not. So what we're not looking for is this quality of being able to digest anything all the time and undue amounts and so on and so forth and still have the desire or the need to eat. That is a clinical category of sharp or intense digestion, and we would want to try to dull that, to cool it down. Desire. Right, desire. To be desired driven. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me ask. I mean, is this sort of assumes that there's some kind of
yeah, but let me just insert some understanding here so that we have an appreciation for these simple words, hunger and appetite. These are the effects of some process more fundamental, digestion. Digestion is the cause, and hunger and appetite are the effect. So we're using your symptomatic report of your hunger or your appetite to assess a more fundamental process of transformation. If you're bored with food, that is, if you can take it or leave it, then your digestion is not good. If you had a balanced digestion, you, assuming many things constant, but if you had a regular routine, a regular lifestyle, and you were active in a regular way, not in acute ways, you run a 20-hour marathon one day and nothing for the other 6 days. You know, what I'm trying to share with you is that there are so many variables to work through in this, but we have to have an understanding of some very simple basics. So, ugly digestion is the cause, and the effect is your appetite. When your appetite changes, then it's because the cause, the root cause of it, appetite or hunger, has changed. So if you don't have appetite or hunger, then the root cause is defective.
Or you're still giving your body what it needs, and so it's not upset.
It may be true that you have little need for food, caloric intake, and so on. That all this may be true, but what we want to establish is, if that is the norm for you, or if it's a pattern of change, if it's a pattern of change, I'm hungry, I'm not, I'm hungry, I'm not, then that quality shows that your digestion is irregular.
It was a pattern for me until the doctors started to say, hey, this is no good, you got to be the norm.
I can't argue with their mindset because I don't understand it. But I'm trying to share a way for you to make sense of a theory. This is the, really going back to the point that I started our discussion with. That this is not folk medicine. This is theory. This is experience-based. It's been a theoretical form probably for over 3,000 years. In written documents, oral tradition, Ayurveda has existed with theoretical statements along the lines of this causes that. Not take this for that, but rather this causes changes here. So the formal system of cause and effect is what we're dealing with, and what we're trying to understand is this principle of cause and effect in an applied way. We're trying to understand what it is about your appetite or your hunger that changes, or what its nature is, that it is revealing about some fundamental process in you that's this pitta substance up here that governs transformations. If your hunger is not right, if it's changing, if it's dull, you have no interest in food, you salt because you don't get enough taste out of things, then we want you to understand that there's something fundamental in the physiology that's gone wrong. It's out of balance in our words, in our language, is balance and imbalance. We want you to focus on balance and imbalance. So if your appetite is stable, healthy, you digest the food that you eat in a timely way, and it doesn't cause undue distortions, gas, bloating, heaviness, dullness, fatigue, sleepiness, drowsiness, any of these things and more, then your digestion is good. And you have the benefits of it, of good health. So if it's other than good, and we're trying to understand now the clinical term so that we can apply a therapy that matches the term. So So let's take another report. Does anybody else want to volunteer? Yes. So sharp as a clinical category, appetite is always strong. You need to eat 3 meals per day. Cannot skip a meal is even, it's there. It's like hypoglycemic, right? Hypoglycemia, you run out of energy, you need to fill in thing, stack. You need to stack between meals, you have excess thirst. If you have more than one of these, then you get the sense that this person's process of digestion is unduly strong, out of balance in an unduly strong way. So if it's out of balance in an unduly strong way, then we want to subdue that energy, this 100 egg a meal appetite, we want to subdue that, and we have some ways to work on it biochemically, behaviorally, energetically, and so on. So, can digest anything. That was the point that was raised earlier. I can eat, but do you digest it? If you can eat a heavy meal and lots of feel, overeat and still come out ahead, then that's a sharp meal, a sharp appetite, sharp digestion. You can binge and still digest it quickly and have maybe a snack after that, then that is a sharp appetite. Clinically, we would say that that's sharp. I had a client in India when I was there visiting in 98, and he came to me as a friend of my host who was a clinician, an Ayurvedic clinician. And he had sharp digestion. He had strong appetite, unduly strong. And I gave him one of the regimens that we call for is drinking. Everybody know ghee, clarified butter? Anybody not know clarified butter? Well, it's an interesting substance because in Ayurveda we say that fat really greases the wheels. If you have a dull appetite, one of the classical authorities says, take animal fat or take fat, and that will kindle the agni, kindle the digestion, the process. The flame will burn brighter, and we've seen that. You add oil to the fire and it burns. So if you add a lot of oil, it puts out the fire. And that's what we got him to do, and his appetite was subdued. And that's what we did with the yogi, who was 100 eggs a meal character. We had him drink probably a liter or something at a time, and for some days of ghee. So it overruns the body's ability to release hydrochloric acid and to make digestive enzymes and so on, and his appetite was normalized. But this is not roll eggs or, you know, this is not that concept. We're not playing with biochemistry. We're not trying to suppress the symptom. We're trying to change the physiology. And so that's why I made this point that your appetite, your hunger is the result of a more fundamental process. We want to understand what that fundamental process, what it's like, what its nature is, if it's balanced or imbalanced. If it's imbalanced, how is it imbalanced? And then we can go about its therapeutic. So appetite is dull. I see this in people who are often with appetite is dull. I find it very often is associated with people who don't have an appetite for breakfast, and maybe not even an appetite for dinner, for the evening meal. Appetite is dull. They could eat one meal a day and sometimes not even have an appetite for it. That's an important discernment. So we know that the agni, the digestive process, is weak. And in that particular case, if you eat as is culturally common in the United States, where you have something for breakfast, something quick, and maybe a snack or a lunch or a salad for lunch, excuse me, breakfast, a coffee or toast, a donut or something light, then a little bit more substantive for lunch, but a big meal at night, you're calorie intake is all inverted. It needs to be changed. And if I have a few minutes to talk about that, I'll go into that, but we're running out of time. So bottom line is that when you have an appetite, you should eat. If you don't have an appetite, you shouldn't eat. And the reason is the appetite is the result of something fundamental. No appetite, the underlying process of digestion is not taking place. So if you can't digest, it doesn't make any sense to eat. This is the fundamental dictum of treating fever. You have fever, you don't feed the fever with food. You give moisture, you just keep the body fluids, right? You don't put food in the body. The body can't digest in the stomach. It's digesting in the tissues. You see? So this concept of digestion is really central to health and to disease and its disturbed manifestations. But we need to make the discernment of what is its nature and then apply the therapeutics. So let's turn the page, and if it turns out that through a re-examination of your responses that you think that you qualify as variable, and it says Vata is affecting it, and that's a topic for another day. But if it's variable, then the first bullet point is daily routine recommendation. RX is a recommendation. And the central theme energetically for variable appetite or variable digestion is regularity of the major features in the daily life. This is an energetic proposition. It means that if you use energy, if you mobilize the resources of the body in a regular way, that the processes that it undertakes will be governed in a regular way. This is just an energetic concept. No biochemistry, no antacids, no digestive stimulants, or any of none of this medicine, modern medicine. This is all energy at this point. Yoga. So there are different ways to balance the system, and the concept of balance is nurtured by alternate nostril breathing. If you know a little bit about the human anatomy and physiology, you know that the left brain controls the right side of the body, and right brain controls the left side of the body. And when we think to breathe on the right side, then the left brain does that, and vice versa for the right brain onto the left side, the left nostril. And that alternately activates the brain and then the physiology of the left side and the right side of the body. This alternate activation helps to balance the functioning of the total body. This is an energetic proposition. It's not biochemistry, but it's energy. This is Ayurveda is at least half, conceptually, it's at least half energy medicine. And we're dealing with fundamental processes. We're affecting digestion as an energy, as a functional theme. We're affecting its vitality or its quality with energy. So, dietary recommendations. So, now, for those of you who are concerned about doctors' recommendations in the modern era versus the Ayurvedic ones, dietary recommendations that are in this category of eating guidelines. So it shows up, eat only if hungry, avoid skipping meals when hungry, strictly follow all other eating guidelines. If you go to my website, I've written the website up there, there's a diet sheet. It might be for Vata or Pitta or Kapha balancing, and it'll say with eating guidelines. And so if somebody wants this, I'll give this my copy up to one person here. But it has on that website, on that diet, foods and eating guidelines. So some of the eating guidelines are eat only if hungry, avoid skipping meals, don't snack, right? Don't eat at a certain time, so no food within 3 hours of going to bed. So these are eating guidelines, and these are energetic. All of these are energetic. There's no biochemistry at all there whatsoever. No antacids, no digestives, just energetics. So the theme of eating guidelines embraces what to eat, when to eat, how to eat, and food combinations. It's a very complex subject. But it's very simply spelled out for you in very simple do or don't do form and on the website. Eating guidelines on meals. So, in this particular case, we think that eating sweet, sour, and salty predominant tastes will help balance the physiology as far as digestion is concerned. This needs to be qualified by other features that are too technical for this discussion at the moment, but it's a simple starting point that is generally useful to favor sweet, sour, and salty tastes if you have variable appetite or variable digestion. Specific digestive aids on the fourth bullet point. This is biochemistry. So Ayurveda is using energy and biochemistry. So all pungent spices in moderation. They have their chemical nature, they're hot, and they have their energetic nature, they're hot, they have their chemical nature, they might have volatile oils, so asafoetida, ajwain, basil, cardamom, cayenne, cinnamon, clove, coriander, cumin, fennel, all of those have volatile oils, and those volatile oils act as digestive stimulants. it's a little bit technical, but the stomach responds to digestive stimulants, the pancreas responds to certain digestive stimulants, the small intestine responds to digestive stimulants, and the liver responds to digestive stimulants. All four of those organs are involved in digestion. So digestion is a little bit complex, but digestive stimulants can be useful in working on a weak pancreas or a weak stomach or a weak liver function like that. And the spices that all of you here who've done any cooking whatsoever will have at least one of these in your cupboard. Even if it's only black pepper, right? Everybody had black pepper, so it's a digestive spice. Has many uses in Ayurveda. It happens to be good for eyesight. And we say that it helps. It's helpful for use in an early stage, if we use it in early stage, cataracts for the prevention of cataracts. Black pepper. Cinnamon is, some of you may have heard of research that associates it with LDL. LDL is favorably affected by cinnamon intake. Clove, likewise. Ginger, likewise. So there are lots of biochemical properties here that are of interest to us, but the bottom line is that we can use digestive aids along with energetic principles in order to balance digestion. Okay? That's the bottom line. And there are some herbal teas that are given here and so on. So you can read the rest of the sheet and see what seems work right for you, but I just wanted to give you some information that would help you to help you identify what to do with your digestion. So I'll take questions if we have any questions. Yes?
Are there different recommendations for weight loss and with scattering water?
Yes. So weight loss is not a simple do it this way, do it one way category. I'll give you an example of the issue of weight loss and diet. Diet and weight loss. If you have a general condition of inflammation, you will have a tendency towards either emaciation or weight gain. But the more common is weight gain. The body has an immune response, and that immune response is an inflammatory response. One of the chemicals that's associated with it is called C-reactive protein. And when C-reactive protein levels are high, we find that two things manifest. One is obesity, and the second tendency is the tendency for diabetes. Just because the body has a general inflammatory condition. So one of the things that might be useful for you to appreciate our view of life is that we think if you could purge the body of inflammatory substances, you could put out the fire. The body is trying to put out the fire by adding water, right? The mechanism of putting out the fire in the modern day scenario is, in most cases, add water. So the body does that. Cataract formation is an inflammatory response in the eye where the body's using water molecules to put out the fire. So it's the same process in the body at large. So the person who has an inflammatory condition will want to avoid aggravating the source of inflammation. And the source of inflammation is toxicity, infection, and too much of this substance we call pitta. It is by its nature hot. It produces inflammation. So all the foods that promote inflammation need to be carefully monitored in that diet. One of my friends is a urologist. He's been practicing many years, and I was a clinical advisor to him as a patient or as a client in Albuquerque, and after some years he decided to try to apply our energetic thinking to his practice. And he told me over the summer, last summer I think, he had conducted a scientific experiment of his 45 of his patients who were variously young and old, male and female, but they all had UTI, urinary tract infection. He got a 91% cure rate with just taking the fire out of the diet, a pitta pacifying diet, pitta balancing diet. No chemistry, no antibiotics, no steroids, just took the energy out of the diet, okay? So it might be that if you have a problem with weight, that your problem is related to inflammation. The source of inflammation, it has many things. It might be drug, it might be prior medicines, it might be infections, it might be toxic environmental toxins. They're almost all inflammatory. All of them stimulate this substance we call pitta. It's going to exacerbate, excite all processes. And it has a strong, as a category, these xenotoxins, environmental toxins, have a strong affinity for the reproductive tissue. So this is one of the rational reason bases in our way of looking at it, why breast cancer, ovarian cancer, prostate cancer are so high. Because the chemicals have an affinity for the tissues of the site and are all inflammatory. Cancer responds to, or we could say the incidence of cancer is very much associated with inflammation. Chronic irritation that's inflammatory is a real impetus for cancer. So energetically, what we do is we cool the body down by giving you foods which are cooling. Coconut, grape juice, pomegranate, sweets, bitters. Bitters are really good, and bitters are good for cleaning up the various channels, the large and the small channels, and even it's a good antiparasitic, anti-helminthic. Bitter is the central taste of almost all herbal medicine. That's why herbal medicines are so much disliked, because the principal taste of medicines, principal, not exclusive, but the principal taste of herbal medicines is bitter. It's antipyretic, anti-inflammatory, anti-helminthic, anti-tumoral, it's goes on and on and on. Natural properties that the bitter things tend to manifest. So, with respect to weight loss, if it's not drug-induced, not doctor-induced, it might be environmental toxin-induced. If it's not that, it might be your diet-induced. Okay? Just your diet. I have a client who wasn't complaining of weight loss, but he was complaining of inflammation. And he was very active. He liked to fly a lot and travel around, I don't know if the world, but at least the United States. And I said, I don't guess there's anything I can get you to do to stop traveling. And he said, I don't think so. I said, well, maybe I can help you with your diet. And he had arthritic knee. And I said, just on an intuition, one thing that occurs to me that might be relevant in your case is that a lot of people drink a glass of orange juice for breakfast every morning. He said, yeah, I do. I said, okay, good, stop that. Now, I don't know what other things he did. I gave him a list of anti-inflammatory foods, but at least he stopped the orange juice and the inflammation went away and the arthritis stopped. Then his daughter called me, a student of mine, and she said, my dad's got arthritis again. Can you talk with him? I said, yeah, have him call me. And he called me, and I said, I remembered our conversation. I said, now, something else that I think might be relevant is people who eat fish a lot tend to have arthritic pain. He said, I have fish every day once or maybe twice. You know, so here it is. What we're talking about is energetic medicine. We're not talking about steroids. We're not talking about biochemistry. We're just talking about energy. And this Ayurvedic insight cured his arthritis. Simple energetic properties of the food. Not biochemical, not nutrients and so on. It was the energetic properties of the food. Well, parasites and I didn't say fungal infection, but infection as a general thing can be responsible for a swelling of the body. So, it's as a technical matter, it would really be beyond the purview of our talk today to go into.
That's because of poor digestion.
Yes. 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 I just want to finish up as a response. The general response to your question, in my study of the subject, of the literature of what is authoritative in Ayurveda, says that there are six categories of themes of influence of causation, six categories of causation. Vata, Pitta, and Kapha govern the physiology, they maintain it, they construct it, but they get influenced by themselves if they get too much or altered in their energetic nature. Pitta gets cold, but it has plenty of it, so the body gets oily. It doesn't get hot, but it gets oily. Just the energetic nature of Pitta changes. So, infection can lead to inflammation. Toxicity can lead to inflammation. So, environmental toxicity or infectious agents. Vata, Pitta, Kapha themselves, mental, emotional things. The mind is very powerful. If you're not happy, then your immune response is down. If you're not happy, then you're making chemicals that destroy red blood cells. If you're not happy, a lot of bad things can happen. They don't have to be inflammatory, but they might be. If you're angry, I will assure you that it will tend to be inflammatory. The body's response will tend to go in the inflammatory direction. If you're judgmental, if you're critical, if you're aggressive, if you're competitive, all of these things work to promote inflammation in the body. This is mental, emotional. Spiritual cause. Ayurveda says that the Indians had it right. I'm talking about the Native American Indians and other cultures where they said that spirits are around and they do affect them. As far as we're concerned, that this is a category of influence. It's a broad category. I'll just make this reference to it and go on. And the sixth area is nourishment. Ayurveda doesn't talk about vitamins and minerals as nutrients. But it does identify the category of undernourishment as a category for disease. We know that you get rickets, you get scurvy, you get other kinds of diseases from malnutrition, undernourishment. Not calories, but nutrients. So these six categories influence Vata, Pitta, Kapha. And a correct assessment of an individual's problem has to look potentially at each one of these six and say yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. If yes, 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 and yes, or yes, 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 no, then the yeses have to be dealt with as a clinical category. The treatment of toxicity is different than the treatment of infection. You get my point. The clinical properties of therapeutics are different for each one of these categories of causation. Each one is treated with a different method. things that treat the mind don't necessarily work very well on the body, and vice versa. So things we did to clean out the body didn't do anything for the mind, maybe. It made it felt a little better, but it didn't, you know, it didn't really settle fundamental unhappiness or disease. So this is the salient point of understanding that there are six etiological categories for why we get sick. Not poison included, not trauma, not genetics and those categories. But these are things, these six are the ones we can treat and can make some control over. The others we can't. So understanding this point is central to being able to treat disease and to maintain health, prevent disease. Ayurveda does it energetically, Ayurveda does it biochemically, we use the mental, we use the emotional, we use the spiritual, we use all of these things. They're formally elements of our theoretical system. The thing that separates allopathy from, one of the things that separates allopathy from the Ayurvedic perspective is their view of life does not include spirit. It will never be able to address spirit possession or issues that deal with the influence of the spirit on a physical entity. And it never, ever worked. One of my clients, I may have told this group before, I'll just repeat it if I did. One of our clients in Albuquerque came to us as an invitation to one of our students who is a practicing licensed psychiatrist. He treated this woman with everything known to science, electroshock, chemicals, psychotherapy, anything, everything, nothing worked. And my teacher, Dr. Lyde, felt her pulse and told me to touch her in a certain way in a certain place, and he touched her in a certain place in a certain way. And I think he said some things and thought some things, and after a few minutes, he took me, the psychiatrist, out into the hall, and he said, "This is a case of spirit possession." And the interesting thing, after the client left, three or four of my colleagues said that each in her own way had seen something leave when we were touching. I don't know the outcome of that, but all that I'm saying is that if your model as a science doesn't include a parameter, then it will never be able to address that issue. It will never be able to ask, what do I do if there is spirit possession? Do you understand? In the late 80s, early 90s, JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, polled its membership asking if members felt that there was a mind-body connection. At that time, those who responded, only 10% said that there is, in their judgment, a mind-body connection. 89, 90, somewhere in there. If you don't have it in your model that the mind is capable of influencing physiology, then you'll never be able to fix physiology if it's a mental cause. Do you understand? So what I'm sharing with you is some fundamental nuances of Ayurvedic theory. Energetic, biochemistry, we accept the whole spectrum of things, mind, body, spirit, emotions, all of these parameters and various nuances of ecological factors. All of these things need to be massaged. We need to be aware of them, and as clinicians, we work with all of them if we're careful, and we make that determination whether it's A, B, C, and not D, E, and F of the causal factors. With my clients, I always try to go over this assessment, and I can't make specific recommendations for spirit possession. I don't often make a statement that I think it's an issue. But some people have asked me. Some of the Vaidyas, the doctors, take the pulse, and some of them do it by intuition, and they can feel that spirit possession. There's a special pulse that we use for diagnostic purposes. I've had people ask me, and I know about the pulse, but I don't know how to detect it. So.
Well,
Yes, this is a sister science. Ayurveda believes and associates itself with everything that says Veda. Ayurveda, Tapatya Veda, Rig Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda, Yajur Veda, Dhanur Veda, all of these things that associate themselves with Veda. And with respect to Jyotisha, this is one of the Vedangas, the limbs of the Veda, which has been designed to forecast and to understand the effects of karma, to predict the timing of it, the nature of it, and to offer remedies. That's the difference in the Eastern system versus the Western system. We think that we have energetic things which can influence the nature and expression, timing of karma. So, as a clinician, sometimes my clients ask me to look at their jyotish. I have some software that predicts, and I have a little training in it, and I can make some simple discernments. But I'm not good at the remedy. You need a person who's got good remedy background and training for that to work on your karma. I can work on your karma with some simple remedies, but not necessarily specific remedies. So a simple general remedy is meditation. Everybody here knows about meditation. Everybody here knows about the whole system of yoga. And there are eight things, and one of those things is samadhi, and there's concentration, withdrawal, and say the senses, and so on. And all the process of meditation is there. So Jyotisha, the light, the inner light, is an intimate member of our science, and many good clinicians, Ayurvedic clinicians, are Jyotishis, at least on an amateur basis. And excuse me, if you don't know, this is worth noting that many of the Galileo and many of Da Vinci and Leonardo and many of the well-known brains throughout the ages have dabbled in it. They have the signs and all the artifacts.
So. Could you give us a one-minute explanation of Shitali?
Shitali? So this is the principle of energy. Dogs do it. They pant with their tongues out, you know. So if you curl your tongue, stick it out, you breathe over it, it feels cold. And for the person who has intense agni, one way to cool the body is just to breathe. Yeah, you feel it? This is a radiator. You're conducting the cold, the heat out, you're evaporating the heat and taking the cool in. The radiator part is the circulatory system, but this is the physical mechanism for it. The skin is another, but unless you have the wind blowing on it, then you can do it over here. Right? Simple. Energy. It's the nice thing about Ayurvedic medicine. We can talk all day about energetic nuances that don't really cost you anything or they're part of your daily living. So energy is a very important part of what we do and how we work and how we think. It's intimate to causation, and it's also obviously intimate to remedy. I have no breakfast. I drink 1 to 2 pints of water. I drink a pint of water when I get up. I meditate for an hour and a half. After I meditate and I do some breathing, then I drink another pint of water. That's within the first hour and a half or so of the day. At lunch I eat. It's the main meal of the day. I'm a vegetarian, so I a lot of rice and beans in the Indian diet, but you could do red beans or chickpeas or green beans or whatever. Any grain and any bean in combination produces what the nutritionists call a whole protein. The amino acids are present for a whole protein. So I have to give that primary consideration, and I'll have a vegetable or two or three, or I might even have a fruit with the meal. That fruit might be an apple, might be half an apple, it might be pineapple, a good digestive, it might be an orange, a good digestive, and I might drink hot water with lemon or lime or just hot water. I mentioned this in the last time that I talked. I think some of you put that into practice and found that alone was enough to give you good relief for indigestion. So the dinner, I have, as long as my physical life, the physical activity schedule is not heavy, I'll eat an apple for dinner, or maybe two apples, or a handful of nuts, and apple or pineapple. Pineapple slices, fresh pineapple, or something like that. Grapefruit. But I can be, as long as my activity schedule remains light. As soon as I start doing a lot of time tracking, then if I do that for day in and day out, then I eat heavier. I may have a breakfast of some fruit or pastry or something, more likely a fruit or nuts. I don't eat eggs very much, so, but then I might have a heavier dinner. When I was in France for the last month, and I hardly ate anything at all for dinner. I had a small lunch and no breakfast, and that suited me fine as long as my activity level matched it. So this is the thing about digestion and hunger. You need to listen to your body. The hunger is the tuning fork, you know. You listen, you hear it, and it tells you what to do, what pitch it's on, is if it's balanced or not, and then you make your adjustments. Our motto is practice self-referral. Listen to your body and honor that. Whatever the body seems to like, that's what you should do. And you don't need my list of things of do's and don'ts. If you listen to your body and you listen to the responses, if you get congestion after some item of the diet, then you have to begin to think in terms of what produced that congestion. We know salt things do it, sour things do it, sweet things do it, and so like that. But, you know, self-referral is the most important simple device for good health. It is. And if you are living moment to moment, then your happiness is moment to moment. It's not contingent upon developments and outcomes and achievements and so on. So I'm not saying that that's where I am, but I'm saying that that's what we try to practice. That's what we counsel. So I think you may have some other activity here. So I just want to...
You said you eat heavier enough.
I don't.
I
might have rice and beans. I might have some rice and beans or something like that, yeah. So, for people who want to lose weight, usually I try calorie restriction in the form of no carbohydrates at night. Fruit, green vegetables, no carrots, no sugar, no beets, no carbs, no white potatoes, no sweet potatoes, you see? So this is the difference of quantity of food and quality of food. This is another topic for another time, but when you massage this, you eat a little heavy foods, a little bit of nuts are satisfying, where you might have to eat a whole loaf of bread or of processed bread or a lot of raw salad or something to get the same effect as a little bit of heavy nuts. So this is another part. So thank you for your attention, and until next time, namaste.
My favorite Jesus.